So good afternoon to everybody, and thanks for being here. And first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for organizing such a very interesting and stimulating workshop, and also for inviting me to speak. So it's my pleasure to be here and present my research. And so what I'm presenting here is a work done with Giulio, and you can find it in a paper that was published very recently, at the end of December, after, let's say, a long period of, let's say, editorial process that it took a lot of time for the journal just to process the accepted result. Anyway, so this result, as I said, is about how to define and study microcanonical thermodynamics in general physical theories, and what we can learn from thermodynamic analysis in those theories. This is part of a larger project about the foundations of thermodynamics. And by foundations, I mean several things have been said about how to find interesting and well-posed foundation for thermodynamics. So here we are taking a slightly different approach. So we work in general physical theories, for example, with respect to more other standard approaches that work, for example, in classical theory, and they study, for example, ergodic systems and under which conditions it's meaningful to talk about thermodynamic systems. So why do we work in general physical theories? Partly because it's interesting per se to see what kind of features of thermodynamics are valid across physical theories, and why thermodynamics itself is such a general paradigm across science and so valid in all different disciplines, but also partly because we want to understand those physical theories better. In particular, we want to take an operational, and which also means informational, point of view for the foundations of thermodynamics. Operational means related to something that maybe an agent in a laboratory can perform and study what the influence of these agents is and compare the influence of agents in one theory to the influence of agents in other theories and what we can say in general, let's say. Let's start. And in particular, we are going to focus on a specific example, the simplest examples of thermodynamics, which are for systems with well-defined energy. Which are called microcanonical systems. So in these analyses, we're going to use, again, an agent-based approach, which is explained and, let's say, takes place in the setting of resource theories. So resource theories are just, I guess, many of you, or probably all of you, are already familiar with what they are, but I just thought of giving a brief recap of what they are and what they mean for this set, for this project and these results. So we have a set of resources, and clearly the definition of resources vary based on the particular problem we are going to solve. And also, I should say, also even agent dependent, I should say, right? Because what is resource for some particular task may not be the same resource for another particular task. And the important distinction is that some resources are free and some others aren't. The resources that are free means that the agent or whoever is acting on the system is able to perform them at no cost. So they are very easy to perform. They are natural. They are kind of obvious way to interact. So we are thinking of these agents like a person with a restricted ability to manipulate a physical system. And therefore, we also distinguish between transformations that are free, which means they can be enacted very easily by the agent, and others that instead aren't. So the important thing is that these free operations give a pre-order on resources by which we say that a resource A is more valuable than a resource B if we can find a free operation, so the agent has some kind of easy choice to manipulate A and get to B. That's the idea. And in particular, in the thermodynamic setting, what we know is that this pre-order gives what kind of thermodynamic transitions are allowed in the theory, so in line with the second law of thermodynamics that says which states can be reached from a given state, let's say. And in particular, this approach has been has become very popular recently for the study of microscopic and quantum thermodynamics, and a lot of results have been produced using these approaches. So I want now to use this very fruitful and successful approach to study instead these very specific problems about thermodynamics in a very general setting, I'd say. So the second part is, how do we deal with general physical theories here? I mean, probably everyone knows, so I just put a slide just for to remind people maybe about the notation. So I'm using the framework of graphical calculus and OPT. So we have states, which are associated with preparations. We have a transformation that can act on systems. And then we can build circuits like that one. And the basic rule is that whenever we have a circuit with no external wires, which means starts with a preparation and ends with some sort of observation, this is associated with a joint probability of all the non-deterministic events that are present in this circuit. So this is very abstract, very operational, means that something we can do in a laboratory. But in the following part of the talk, you will also see some more familiar notions like summations, like the concept of pure transformations. How are they defined? So the fact that we have probabilities, which are real numbers, clearly induce a sum for transformation, because every, for example, a state can be viewed as a map from effects to probabilities, and so on, and similar for transformation. So we can define real vector spaces. And for the scope of this result, we will assume that they are finite dimensional. And of course, then we can define purity as, let's say, the lack of coarse graining, and by means of the sums we have introduced. So in particular, we say that transformation is pure if every, expression of this transformation in terms of a sum means that actually this sum is trivial. So it's just like the same transformation times some probability distribution, and which is coarse grained on. So this is like the basic introduction. So now let's come to the core of the talk. So I would say that it's divided into two parts. The first part is just a very general treatment of what it means to have a microcanonical description in a theory, and what it means to introduce resource theories in order to study the thermodynamic transitions present in this setting. And the second part instead is, as in the spirit of Giulio's previous talk, when he said that actually at some point we need some more structure in order to be able to see what kind of consequences we can derive and what happens when we get close enough, for example, to quantum theory. So this will be, let's say, the subject of the second part of the talk. So I'll focus on some theory that are quite close to quantum theory, and see what the thermodynamic implications for those theories are. And of course, this also helps us understand, by focusing on this kind of foil theories, to why quantum theory may be special, why we should consider quantum theory, but this time not like from the usual informational reconstruction angle, but more from a thermodynamic angle. What can we say about this in terms of maybe the influence of the structure of quantum theory as far as microcanonical thermodynamics is concerned. Right, so now let's start with this. So what's microcanonical thermodynamics? The simplest example, that when you start studying statistical mechanics, in textbook that's the first thing they present you, because it requires, let's say, the least conceptual amount of notions. So the key point is that here we describe a system where the energy is fixed. So not like the temperature is fixed, like in the canonical thermodynamics. Here we instead focus on what's the energy. So the important thing is that in every thermodynamic treatment, there are always some kind of macroscopic constraints that are imposed on the system, which then basically imply some structure for the underlying dynamics of the theory. And this is no different. So once we fix the energy, we impose this postulate, which is one of the standard postulates of statistical mechanics. So whenever we impose a macroscopic restriction, all the states, the microscopic states compatible with that macroscopic restrictions are equally probable. And so this was long debated and what it means, why it arises, why it's a good assumption and so on, from the study of dynamical systems, quantum chaos and so on. So here instead we don't want to see, let's say, the origin of this principle, but rather to see what the minimal constraints are in order to talk about this principle and see and to express it in a meaningful way, right? And as I said, this has been studied so far only in classical and quantum theory. Now we want to go also beyond, and also, I mean, with the idea of understanding why classical and quantum theory are special. In this case, I should say quantum theory is special, and what it means, let's say, for that. Right. So the first problem we encountered is how do we impose the restriction on the energy, since that in general physical theories, we don't know what the energy is, because we know that the classical system is beta-Hamiltonian, quantum system is beta-Hamiltonian, but what for the rich landscape in between, let's say, right? What can we say? Because it's not even clear what energy is in such an abstract operational setting. So what can we say? Well, actually, luckily, we don't need to know all the details about the dynamical structure of the theory, because all in all, let's see what happens in quantum theory when we want to impose the restriction on the energy. Basically, so when we project on the eigenspace with fixed energy, you see that the states that are compatible with this constraint satisfy a linear constraint, right? So we will be guided by this, and start talking about restricted systems in general probabilistic theories and how we can impose this energy restriction. So we say that microcanonical systems obey some linear constraint, which we can just write like this, where L is just like a linear operator on states. This is what we mean. So what are the transformations? Because the ultimate goal would be to construct a theory where effective systems are those kind of restricted systems. So here I'm talking about a slightly different, let's say, framework than Giulio explained this morning. So it's kind of interesting that we have two, let's say, definition of subsystem and restricted systems in the same day, but this is not like the same thing. So here we are just imposing a linear restriction. And of course, the allowed transformation shouldn't map states outside of this. So in this setting would be that maps will be kind of energy preserving. And we allow all possible effects in this setting, because effects don't have any restriction, because they can be applied to all possible states. So there's an interesting part related to composition of systems, because the usual approach in this state is when we deal with a composite system, we just impose the restriction, for example, of the energy on the composite system, and we let the energy of the two components, let's say, fluctuate freely, with the only constraint that the sum of the energy of the two parts be like the total energy. But here we want to keep an operational and compositional meaning, because, for example, we want to be able to associate like a physical system to every degree of freedom, let's say, and to every, let's say, constraint in the energy. So if we just constrain, for example, the total energy, and we are dealing with photons, for example, it may well be that one of the allowed state is just a state which is just like a mixture of different, a superposition of different states with different photon numbers, which of course breaks the idea that the composite system is made of two smaller components, one photon plus another photon, let's say. Yes?
What you just said would be a problem if you... No, I didn't follow it.
So what usually happens is that I impose one restriction, which is like on the joint, on the composite states, which is just like, I don't know, maybe the sum of the two parts, LA plus LB prime. Right? That's the idea. Instead, this means that just a constraint on the joint system. Here,
if you did that, and we talked about the quantum case, wouldn't you only get superpositions of different ways of distributing the energy among the components?
Yes.
And so why would that be a problem?
Well, if we want to attach a physical meaning to this kind of way of distributing the energy, because as I said, in the case of photons, you think that the energy of photons of a given mode come in discrete unities. In this case, having superposition of different energies like this would be like having superposition of, let's say, different case of different photon numbers, let's say, right?
But it doesn't. It seems to me it's not a superposition of different photon numbers. It's a superposition of different relative photon numbers. So for example, I could have 0, 1, plus 1, 0. So there's one unit of energy, and it's superposed between being in system A and being in system B.
Yes.
But it's still an eigenstate of total energy.
Yeah, definitely.
Any superposition.
No, I mean, in that sense, yes. But
you're forbidding that by doing it this way.
Yeah, definitely.
And why? Why are you forbidding?
Because essentially, we want to keep, let's say, the basic compositional structure of the theory. We don't want, one of the reasons also we don't want to deal, for example, with cases like the canonical state, which may arise in this setting when I'm tracing out a large system, right? That is jointly in a.
So what you're saying is that the systems cannot exchange energy?
In some sense, yes. That's basically what the constraint amounts to in this case, yes.
Can you finish what you were saying?
Yeah. So the idea we can also phrase it like this is like more a formal requirement in order to construct also an operational theory of restricted systems. Because these restricted systems are just systems where I fix the energy in each of them. And I want to be able that to basically, when I compose them and I have everything, let's say, to attach this meaning of fixing the energy to every possible, let's say, to have this kind of consistent way of composing systems such that this idea is preserved.
So maybe if I can interject, I think what Carlo Maria wanted to say is that in this way you can talk about, I don't know, a polarization qubit. So your original system would be the mode of the field, like polarization modes of the field for a certain color of the light. And you can define a polarization qubit to say this is the specific subspace where you have only one photon Fock numbers for linear combinations of vertical and horizontal. So this is what we do when we make a qubit picture of the photon. Now I say, okay, let's say I have a red photon and a blue photon. What is the composite system of these two photons together? So I want the red photon to still be a qubit and the blue photon to still be a qubit so that I have a two qubit system. Whereas you should just say something like I want a constant and a total excitation of the system to be at most to be two, let's say. You would have also the case where you have two photon Fock states for the red and zero for the one.
Indeed.
This wouldn't depict anymore the situation where there is one qubit here, one qubit there, and you compose them.
There are
physical situations where the conservation of the total energy is more relevant, but somehow here is trying to describe that situation. Right?
Okay.
You have the one photon system, another one qubit here, one qubit there, and then you put them together, and they are still qubits.
That helps me understand your formal motivation, but I'm still a bit concerned because if I think of just the basic arguments about microcanonical ensembles, they really are all about ways of distributing energy among a set of systems. Like, you know, if I say I've got a big system here and a small system here, how many ways are there of distributing a fixed amount of energy?
Yeah.
Now, you've just defined something that says you specify the energy, but you have to specify a fixed energy for every subsystem. It seems counter to the kind of philosophy of what I usually see.
Think about what you do in a resource theory when you say, okay, I give for free the invariant states, not the maximally mixed state. You need to do this in order to do that. You say, like, I have one system, maximally mixed state. I have another, maximally mixed state. When I put the two together, I have the product.
Mm-hmm.
If instead I had just a constant of the total energy,
mm-hmm.
you would not have the
yes.
product of maximally mixed state, but you have some projector on this
right.
total energy subspace. So I'm trying to get to model that scenario where you add more maximally mixed states, and the maximally mixed states of the composite system is the product.
So this is basically the resource theory of non-uniformity.
Indeed.
GPTs.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
Right.
Yes, and the case I wanted to rule out, like the case of having this situation, which I have some kind of exotic state in the reduced one when I'm at the equilibrium.
Okay.
Great. So. As I was saying, the energy of the two stays fixed, so that's the reason why. Okay, the whole point about this is that now I want to forget about the fact that I have this kind of restriction and have a theory of effective systems, which are just kind of restricted, as Julius was saying about the presence of like the polarization qubit in the case of a photon. And then we can definitely forget and then just treat them as, system without caring about the restriction. So what is the equal a priori postulate? We have to translate some things. So the first part, what are the microstates? The microstates are associated with a deterministic pure states. This is what happens in classical and quantum theory. And what is the equal a priori postulate, probability postulate, and the microcanonical state? So this is what ideally we want. We want like the uniform mixture of all deterministic pure states like this. This is how I represent this, where I just put a need to remind of the energy constraint, but this will be the last time where you see this. So that's basically what we want. Now the question is, when can we write this in such a way that it's meaningful for the theory?
An incoherent mixture?
Yes. Because it's just like a uniform probability distribution of all possible states. This thing is going to be the maximally mixed state. So we want this state to be invariant under the reversible dynamics of the theory, where this is what I mean by reversible. So there's an inverse in the sense that both sides of both ways of composing it give the identity. This is one of the, clearly that must be true in the case of equilibrium, because this is the case. And in order to have this, we take this to be an invariant probability measure under the dynamics. This is also one of the standard assumptions when one studies like dynamical systems that approach this kind of thermalization. They're always endowed with this measure that's invariant under the evolution of the system, which is reversible. What we demand here is that, of course, this measure must exist. Otherwise, we can't define the object. And it also must be unique for the system, because otherwise, this would be inconsistent with equal a priori probability postulate, because it means that we'll have two equilibrium states given the same macroscopic constraints, which is not what we observe.
So when you say invariant, usually we have a whole group of transformations.
Yes. I'm coming to that one. Okay. Yeah. So the thing is that this object exists in finite dimension, and probably what we were about to say, I'm not sure. This comes from the Haar measure of the associated group of reversible transformation, because the group in finite dimension will be a compact group, and the compact group has a Haar measure, and then we can use this Haar measure and translate and, let's say, lift it or to the set of deterministic pure states by means of the action of the this group of reversible transformations. We have this result that basically, in order for this constraint to be satisfied, we need that the action of reversible transformations on the set of deterministic pure states be reversible. Be transitive. What does it mean to be transitive? It means that if I have a pair of two pure states, I can always find a reversible evolution connecting them. So let's see two examples here. So in the left example, clearly this state has just the identity and the reflection along the vertical axis as symmetries, but pure states are all here on the boundary. And clearly, if I can go from one side from one point here to the symmetric point here, but if I take two pure states on the same side with respect to the vertical axis, then clearly I can't find any reversible transformation connecting them. So this theory doesn't satisfy this microcanonical requirement. So in this theory, it's very easy to see that all states here in between, let's say, are valid, possible valid equilibrium state, but of course this doesn't make sense physically. Instead, in this one, I say this, I have a square, and here the action of reversible transformation is transitive, because if I take any two vertices of the square, I can always find a reversible transformation, which is one of the elements of the dihedral group mapping one to the other. And in this case, I can do the twirling over the group, and then I get the microcanonical state, which is just here at the center of the square. Just to say that actually the shape of the state space matters a lot also in terms of thermodynamics. This is just some, let's say, thought and why this idea about transitivity of the evolution of the action of reversible transformation is kind of natural. So this is more or less in the same spirit of what I'm going to say now. So, you know, if you read any kind of textbook about statistical mechanics, when you read about the microcanonical ensemble, they say, well, the equal a priori postulate is satisfied because we have a dynamic that's so chaotic that basically it visits all possible microstates. And if I start from one point, I just visit all the possible points, right? And this is more or less in the same spirit of what we mean by transitivity, right? Because if I start from one pure state, I can only go to all of them, basically. There's only one orbit of evolution, let's say, in this restricted system. Right. Okay, the interesting thing is that in these theories, the way we define the microcanonical states allows us also to find a way by which we can reach it from starting from any state. And there's an interesting physical explanation to this because we can achieve the equilibrium by considering random fluctuation of the irreversible dynamics. And to see this, consider this kind of particular kind of transformation and then apply to a state. And then by the property that the fact that this is a hard measure, I can just rewrite it in this way. And of course, now I get the microcanonical state here. So now we have this. Since we are working in the finite dimensional case, there is a theorem about convex geometry in finite dimension that this can be replaced by a convex sum. So now we have that basically I start from any pure state here, apply this object here, and get the microcanonical state. And the interesting thing is that this object here is nothing but a random reversible transformation. And this thing will play a big role later on when I talk about different resource theories in this particular setting. So that's this interesting, let's say, fact that this, as we're going to see later, yes?
So can I understand that mixture as like the I index in some finite subgroup of the full?
No. This is not over the group. This is just a an index.
Is it over some finite size subgroup or something like this? Like in the square group?
No. This is valid in general. Basically, it says that whenever it's called the Kara-Theodori theorem of convex geometry. Whenever you have like a convex combination, because this is what basically is just like done through with an integral, you can always in finite dimension you can always replace it like by means of a convex combination with d plus one terms, where d is the dimension of the affine space associated with that.
Is it fair to ask plus a one design?
Sorry?
Is this a one design as well? Or have I got that?
What do you mean exactly?
Is this one design, two designs for generating?
Well,
it's not important.
Yeah, we haven't thought actually about this. It's just the fact that this idea can be reached, let's say the equilibrium state can be reached by means of this random reversible.
It's not necessarily the same PI UI that works for every sub.
That where what?
It would work for every sub.
No, indeed, yes. No, yeah.
No, this works for
the UI, but not the PI.
Sure, the PI too. It's the discretization of the T integral. What I mean by that, by being a one design, is like that integral on the top is equal to the sum on the bottom for every psi.
Yes.
So, yeah, I would say, it's a one design.
Okay. So the last part about the general treatment about microcanonical systems is that we study the composition, and as we said at the beginning, we want these microcanonical states to be candidate for free states, and a basic notion of a free state is the fact that whenever two states are provided for free, they also generate another free state. And of course, in this case, we translate this requirement into this condition of having a product of the two microcanonical systems, and they are brought together and they stay at equilibrium, described again by another microcanonical system. So if the parts are in equilibrium, the whole is in equilibrium, and vice versa. That's related also to the way we compose systems. And note that this is one of the can be proved in textbook statistical mechanics in the thermodynamic limit, where basically you even if you, let's say, remove the constraint that I said, in the approach that you suggest, like the usual one where I just fix the energy of the joint system without fixing the components, we recover this property in the thermodynamic limit because the interaction part is negligible, let's say, in the thermodynamic limit. This is one of the standard calculations that one does. And instead here, by imposing the restriction, we don't have to basically worry about that thing, about considering things in the limit and asymptotically and neglecting some things. Right, yes?
Maybe it's not important, but could you say that the whole thing psi AB must be invariant under all reversible transformations? So let's just take the product transformations. Must be invariant under them, and then this gives you basically...
Yeah, that's also the idea behind this requirement, yes. So now, after this general setting and general, presentation of what's necessary for describing the microcanonical setting, let's now introduce the resource theories and what we can say about that. And of course, as I said, it's natural to take the microcanonical state as free, because like the equilibrium state, processes approach the equilibrium spontaneously. And again, the fact that we are requiring that microcanonical states be stable under tensor products is also another necessary requirement for setting up a resource theory where these are the free states. Now we have three possible choices of free operations. The first are rare channels, rare stands for random reversible. Then we have noisy operations, and finally we have unital channels. Now I'll just briefly explain what they are. So we have, as I said earlier, random reversible channels are those channels that allow to reach the equilibrium state starting from any pure state. Say right. And they can, of course, be written in this form, where just a convex combination of irreversible evolutions. And of course, the physical interpretation is that I have some kind of lack of fine-tuned control over the reversible dynamics, and I have just some random fluctuations. And these random fluctuations make me implement this kind of reversible evolution. Yes?
Do you mean here to consider only those mixtures of unitaries that are one designs that sort of average, or do you mean
no all these are all, yes. The interesting part about this resource theory is that in principle we could define it even in a theory where there are no free states, because let's say in order to for these things to be defined, they don't need any notion of free state. And if you take the abstract approach defined in the paper by Bob Cooke, Rob, and Tobias Fritz, where they study how to derive, the structure of free states from the structure of free transformation by taking some of the input to be trivial, like what happens for states. Basically, here, these transformations go from system A to system A. So if we trivialize system A, we get a trivial transformation. So these free operations don't need any notion of free states. So they're very general, but again, can be applied to all possible theory without without constraint. But still, I mean, we don't say much about the actual structure of thermodynamics of being like, having like a state. Yes.
The set of operations you're defining, does that not already kind of single out the microcanonical ensemble as the free state?
Well, let me explain. So, of course, if I apply these transformations to the microcanonical state, these will be left invariant. But there, let's say that the fact that a state is invariant doesn't mean necessarily that this state is free. This is particularly true also, I mean, if you, the work we're doing also with Jonathan about multiple resources where there are these free, there are some states that are invariant but definitely not free. And it's also an interesting feature of theory. So it's true that these, of course, preserve this. But in general, if I forget about what I had said earlier about the existential microcanonical states, if I just give you this expression for the resource, for my free operation, you're not able to say by fiat that the free state is that one, more or less like in accordance with the principle of cat-motility, right? That you say, so here, if I look at this, I can't conclude anything regarding states. So from this point of view, they're a little bit problematic. Instead, if we move to the second class of operations, these are definitely much less problematic, and they are generated exactly by the ingredient that we want, again, in accordance with the principle of cat-motility. We have preparing the microcanonical state, reversible evolutions, and then discarding systems. Right, this is the usual definition. There, an interesting thing is that they are not topologically closed, as it was shown by Shore. And this has implications, let's say, in proof, because if we only considered transformation of this form, then we wouldn't be able to reach all possible states, but we always had some kind of error, or we could only reach states with a very high degree of approximation, but never exactly. So that's why it's convenient to take the topological closure. And as I said, yes. So the final class is the most general class, where the only constraint I impose is that these transformations preserve the microcanonical state, nothing else. So that's the most general class of free operation. They said free states to free states. That's precisely the thing. So there's very little to say about this, honestly, because the definition is self-explanatory. But here, I want now to talk about the relationship between the different free operations that I've introduced so far. So this is true for general theory. It's very easy to prove that rare channels are unital because they preserve the microcanonical state. And also, noisy operations are unital, given because we are considering this requirement that the product of microcanonical state is a microcanonical state. But we can't say much about the relationship between noisy operations and rare channels. That's why I drew them in this very general setting where there could be an intersection, there could be no intersection, there could be the same, they could be contained one into the other. But this is what we can say, let's say, in this very general setting.
Can I ask about that? Is that due to this topological nuance? Because I would have thought that if you don't worry about those nuances, that all the mixtures of unitaries would be included in the noisy set.
Yes, we'll get to that. We're going to get this later if we impose some other axioms. But in general, we can't say much.
Quantum context.
Yes. Yeah, this is not quantum con. This is a very general setting. Yes. In particular, there is a case where you can show that this is not included here. For example, suppose that your noisy operations are just where you are just restricted to, let's say, local unitaries. So it means product. Where, of course, if I write this as a product, clearly, you see that I don't get all, let's say, random reversible transformation in this way, but only those that are just reversible. If this theory only admits, let's say, local reversible transformations this way.
So one other question: when you cited Shore, he wasn't talking about this generalized problem.
No.
Context.
No,
but his conclusion holding in for the.
Let's say that. Actually, it does, because in one of the proofs later on, we use the fact we need to take the topological closure in order to prove a result. But of course, the original result by Shor was proven in the context of quantum theory. And the result I'm talking about is just the inclusion of of rare channels into noisy operations, because otherwise we could prove the inclusion only for rare channels where the probabilities are all rational. But definitely, you don't want to impose such a restriction. Right. Now, that's the end of the first part of the talk. Now let's move to the second part. And here we add more structure to make things slightly more interesting, closer to quantum theory, and to see what we can derive in such a setting without being actually going to precisely to quantum theory, and what we can say about these thermodynamic concepts and results in these general theories. So these theories, let's say, admit a level of description where everything is pure and reversible. So a very strong kind of assumption. This is not like a very enforced version of the principle of cat motility, where I'm actually able to describe everything in terms of pure things. That's basically the idea. And some examples of these theories are, of course, real complex quantum theory. Then we have more exotic theories with some super selection rules, and also, interestingly, Speckenstein model. But this is, let's say, an effect of the fact that the theory is not convex. Great. So these theories satisfy four axioms. The first one is causality, which means that basically, here I'm going to be quite fast because I guess people know these axioms. Causality means that information basically flows from the past to the future. And this is equivalent to having a single and unique deterministic effect for every system. And we can use such a deterministic effect to, let's say, act like the partial trace and discard systems. And of course, this also has this kind of nice, interesting meaning in terms of thermodynamics, like discarding a system. And maybe I have a big system, and then I want to focus on a smaller one, then I can discard it. And this is allowed by the fact that this is operation or marginalization is well defined. The second one is a purity preservation, where we say that the composition of pure transformations is pure, composition both in sequence and in parallel. And here, of course, one of the consequences is the fact that the product of pure states is pure, but this is not true in general, because in quaternionic quantum theory, this is not the case. And we are imposing this instead of deriving it from local tomography. And the interesting thing, this also has some philosophical implication, because why do we need this principle? Well, because suppose we have an experiment, and the experiment is built out of pure transformations and pure experiments. So now it means that if, when I compose, let's say, devices, I lose information simply by composing. This would pose a serious limitation on experiments, because it means that basically after connecting several devices between them, the information will get lost irreversibly, which is not something we want. Otherwise, we would observe just noise. And there's also another reason why there's also reasonable to assume this principle, because suppose we are composing two pure transformations and their composition is no longer pure, then that means that there is some kind of leakage of information somewhere here, and somewhere basically means in the composition. Instead, one of the basic principles of this way of approaching general probability theory is that every process must be accounted. All processes must be described by boxes. Instead, here there's no box describing this thing. So there's no actual process. It's just an effect of composing things. So this is something we don't find particularly reasonable, at least for a theory that wants to be kind of fundamental. Yes?
About the parallel composition case, you speak as if the composition is sort of bringing devices together, but I would have said in these frameworks it's just sort of considering them together, not necessarily break. I can talk about two systems that are spatially separated and still represent them as a composite. So it seems to me that the content of this assumption is more that there are no holistic properties, that if you've told me everything about this system and everything about this system, then you've told me everything about the composite. So you're sort of ruling out holistic properties.
Yes, indeed, indeed, yes. The third axiom is called pure sharpness. And this means that for every system, there exists at least one pure effect that occurs with probability one on some state. So we can think of one of these effects as a part of a yes-no test. And since this effect is pure, we can say that these tests for something elementary, some elementary property of the system. So this is equivalent to saying that every system possesses one of those elementary properties or something that we consider to be fundamental. Right. And the final one is purification, which comes in two parts. The first part, basically, every mixed state, every state arises as the marginal of some joint pure state. And the second one, instead, is that they have two purifications of the same state. They differ just by a reversible transformation, which means that, more or less, once I know the situation here on system A, the dynamics on system B is almost blocked, more like particle physics terms, they just differ by some sort of gauge transformation on the state. So that's in this way, the theory is a bit rigid. Right, of course, classical theory doesn't satisfy purification. And of course, this is a bit troublesome in some sense because, maybe we are not dealing with classical theory. Well, the thing is that we can extend classical theory conveniently in such a way that it allows for entanglement and satisfies the purification, but at the same time, there are some systems that still look like classical. That's basically how it goes. So I have some classical systems, but when I compose them, there's entanglement arising. So how does it work? Well, I'll just give you an example. The simplest one. So here, suppose I have two bits, so just direct sums of states in the 0 and 1, 0 and 1, basically. And when I compose them, I suddenly introduce some sort of coherence in some subspaces. Of course, the act of introducing this coherence means that this theory won't be locally tomographic, definitely. And so here, basically, I introduce coherence between these states. So I just impose some sort of parity superselection rule, like this. So now states will be just a direct sum of states with support in this subspace with states with support in this other subspace. And it's not hard to check that these theory satisfies all the other axioms, in particular also purification, because since these two sectors are of the same dimension, there's always a hopping, term that makes me connect purification that are, in different subspaces. Right, by a local transformation, I mean. Good. So this is just a sketch. Now let's go to properties of these sharp theory with purification that are of more thermodynamic flavor. There are a lot of properties. Here I just focus on those that are interesting for what I'm going to say. First of all, the action of reversible transformation is transitive. It means I have a well-defined microcanonical state. And secondly, we can prove also this equality, which basically, by the way, implies also that Hardy's information locality is satisfied by these theories. And it means here we prove that the product of two microcanonical states is yet another microcanonical state. So microcanonical thermodynamics is satisfied. So we check this, we are done. But now the interesting part comes here, because one of the main results is that every state can be diagonalized, And by diagonalized, of course, since we don't have any sort of linear structure or matrices here, it means that I can just write it as convex combinations of perfectly distinguishable pure states. And the interesting thing is that now I have these coefficients here, which are just a probability distribution, and these coefficients are unique. So from every state, I can extract a probability distribution in a canonical way, let's say. And interestingly, the equal a priori probability postulate is translated in also in terms of diagonalization, where if I take the microcanonical states, this is diagonalized as the uniform mixture of a maximal set of perfectly distinguishable pure states, where maximal means that I can't add any other state, otherwise there won't be any longer perfectly distinguishable. Another interesting thing is that basically some people like defining the microcanonical state in this way, just say the microcanonical state in quantum theory is this. And here we show that actually this result comes from the equal a priori probability postulate in this nice way that we consider the restricted set of, let's say, the restricted system, then we take this uniform mixture of all microstates by means of the invariant measure, and then we get a microcanonical state, which, by the way, turns out to be diagonalized in this way. Interesting results. And the other interesting thing, this one is completely arbitrary. So if I take any other pure maximal set, I get exactly the same diagonalization. So it's a very convenient writing of this. OK, now we have the eigenvalues. Time to use them, because definitely we want to study if it's possible to, let's say, describe thermodynamic transitions only in terms of those quantities, of those classical probability distributions that we can extract from states, like in the case of quantum theory. But first, let's go back and view the previous inclusions. Now it's possible to prove that in these theories we have the standard inclusions. Actually, the proof is quite long and complicated. So rare channels are included into noisy, which are included into unital channels. And of course, this means that this is like the most restricted set of operations. So if I want to study the convertibility of state, of thermodynamic convertibility of states, this is the hardest to satisfy, because there are the fewest, let's say, operations in this class.
It's the closure of noisy now?
Yeah, I mean, by noisy, I already take the closure, let's say. Indeed, the original terminology we use, like basic noisy operation, if it can be written in this form here, and noisy, like if I take also the closure, yes. Okay, now we have these classical probability distributions, majorization, the standard, let's say, thing when one needs to check, because majorization is, let's say, the practical check that allows us to study thermodynamic transitions in quantum theory, and also in classical theory. Instead of checking all possible free operations, which are kind of very complicated search, and there are an infinite set, I have this very handy tool of majorization. Does it work? Well, it works up to a certain point, in the sense that we have this proposition. So if I want to go from rho to sigma by means of a unital channel, this is possible if and only if the eigenvalues of rho majorize the eigenvalues of the vector of the eigenvalues of sigma. So that's the important thing. This is an if and only if criterion. Right. So it means, looking at the previous inclusion, let me go back. So since this is necessary and sufficient for this, but in particular this is necessary, it means that also necessary for rare channels, this is necessary for noise operation, this is necessary for unital channels. So the question is it sufficient? Because this is what we care about, actually, because if we want to have a handy tool in order to describe thermodynamic transitions, we want, and majorization is such a handy tool, we want it to tell us something about what actually I can perform in the theory in terms of actual maps, because this is just a statement about mathematical vectors, not about physical states. Right, and we have a counterexample. So I'm not sure whether it's worth going into the technical details about this, but just to let you know that there's a theory, maybe we can come back later if you're interested, that in this theory there are states for which I have this majorization relation, but since there is some super selection rule, some unitaries are forbidden, and of course I can't achieve any thermodynamic transition in this case. So definitely majorization is not sufficient for the convertibility under random reversible transformations in general, even in sharp theory of reprofication, because we have this counterexample.
Quick question. Do you know if we have the same eigenvalues to states that you can map one to the other reversibly?
No, no. Except this is precisely the counterexample. Oh. Indeed, it's done reversibly. Yes. Yes, so now the natural question is, maybe I can add something in order to recover this fact that majorization is sufficient. I mean, not just because I like majorization and say, yeah, thermodynamics should be described by majorization, but it's because this is an interesting question, which is, what's the feature of quantum theory that allows me to use majorization to describe these thermodynamic transition? And it turns out that it's related to three equivalent axioms in these theories, but they're not equivalent in general theory. But for sharp theory with purification, these three axioms become equivalent. The first one is Hartley permutability. Take any maximal set of perfectly distinguishable pure state, and then you can permute it, every possible permutation, by means of a reversible channel. And there's another axiom called strong symmetry, which in general is different from permutability, for example, in the case of a square, which means that if I take two pure maximal sets, I can always find a reversible transformation connecting them, also known as bit symmetry, various things, but bit more related to system two-dimensional, but this is general, let's say. And the final one is associated with, again, with this principle of universality and the fact that we can implement control reversible transformation reversibly. So all these three are equivalent. So if I want to implement every control reversible transformation, like in the case we deal with, like a measurement, and we consider the measurement entangling, let's say, the apparatus, and this is in general like a controlled reversible operation, what it's not clear in general that the overall, let's say, transformation can be treated reversibly, is a reversible transformation. So instead, if these axioms are true, then this is the case, I mean, in the context of the other one. So they become equivalent. So why do I make this kind of more axiomatic and technical digression? Because this is going to play a major role now, because now we'll see that those axioms are actually those that are necessary and sufficient to recover the sufficiency of majorization. Sorry for the too many sufficient things. So let's call these three axioms that are equivalent in this setting like unrestricted reversibility, because I can always find this kind of reversible transformation connecting things. Now, the main theorem is the following. Majorization becomes sufficient for the most restricted class. This is the class of random reversible channels. If and only if, that's the important thing. This is not just an if, this is also an only if. And this, I think, the surprising result, the theory satisfies this unrestricted reversibility. So what does it mean in practice? In practice, it means that in these theories, with our sharp theories with purification plus unrestricted reversibilities, the three resource theories of we consider of microcanonical thermodynamics become equivalent, and they are all equivalent to majorization. So we can go from rho to sigma by means of a random reversible channel, or we can go from rho to sigma by means of a noisy operation, or we can go from rho to sigma by means of a unital one, or we have this, so, and they are all equivalent. So I think this is an interesting fact that in order to have this kind of unique notion of purity, let's say, or convertibility of resources, one has to impose an additional axiom on that basically constrains the dynamics of the reversible theory, of the underlying theory. So here we didn't just start from axioms and derive thermodynamic consequences, but we also consider some thermodynamic result in order to derive what axioms the theory should satisfy and what kind of constraints on the dynamics we have. So let me conclude. So we saw how to describe the microcanonical setting. We saw that we need two requirements in order to have a well-defined structure. And then we have introduced three resource theories that in general don't obey very nice inclusion relation, but they have some kind of inclusion, but not like the ones that one would expect. And then we study these resource theories of microcanonical thermodynamics in this specific setting of sharp theories with purification. And we saw that in this case, those theories, the thermodynamic in this theory is interesting, let's say, is similar to what we expect. So, and I would like also to say that, again, interestingly, a thermodynamic requirement about the convertibility of states has also an implication about the structure of the underlying theory. And with that, I have concluded, and I'd like to thank you for your attention. Here are some references. Yes.
So I like this a lot.
thank you.
Thinking a bit logically, you know, in terms of all these axioms and how they fit together. Because it seems in the end you already get a lot of structure.
Mm-hmm.
Especially you get 3 out of 4 axioms that in our paper would bring us down.
Yes.
One theory.
Yes.
So all the other candidate theories that are still lying there would be higher order interference theories.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe, but you also have purification in the picture.
You mean here?
Here.
Yes.
So maybe it would be interesting to study if purification gives you even more information and then you actually land a quantum theory here, or maybe not. Maybe this tells you that whatever these other theories are, actually it might be that they have purification as a property.
So please say it again, because I think I got a bit lost in the sense of what you said. Because here we are assuming purification and other axioms that are basically... being very close to quantum theory. So you say that compared to your paper, basically here, the only thing that's not clear whether there are higher order interference things. That's your question, maybe?
Yes, and it's not clear if purification would rule them out or would be compatible.
Oh, yeah, I can answer this question because we had a paper with John Selby, Kieran Lee, Howard Barnum, and basically even without the strong symmetry, but the other four axioms, they rule out high order interference. So these theories don't have high order interference.
Okay, good. So then we have real and complex quantum theory in the end, basically.
Yeah, and well, there are also some exotic things like the fermionic examples, because it satisfies also the strong symmetry.
Okay, you should show me that later after.
Okay. Yes.
I wonder if the logic of the proof that everything reduces to majorization,
mm-hmm.
right, is analogous to the logic for why, if you study the resource theory, the quantum resource theory of non-uniformity,
mm-hmm.
It's basically a classical resource theory. So,
mm-hmm.
so the logic goes, you know, we
yeah.
allow all unitaries for free. I want to know if rho goes to sigma.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing I could always do is apply unitaries that make rho and sigma diagonal in the same basis.
Yes.
And so now I can just think of them as probability distributions. And so ultimately, it's just the classical resource theory. And then you work out that majorization
yeah.
decides it. So is strong symmetry essentially allowing you to do a similar type of proof that sort of apparent freedom, you know, is something that comes for free?
Well, first of all, we should say that if we would just restrict to unital channels, then majorization is already sufficient. There's nothing to say about this. The problem is that if we insist that we want convertibility under this kind of specific form of channels that are random reversible and that are those that are associated with some sort of equilibration, let's say, in that case, measuring resources is no longer sufficient, because basically it's the restriction that if the theory, in the example I said, has this kind of super selection rule, then I don't have enough unitaries in order to be able to do this, but I have enough unital challenge to do it anyway. That's the thing. So it's an interesting feature, because in any case, the theory is classical, at least for the unital version of the theory. And because, I mean, an interesting question whether here there are any things like with a thermal operation that there's kind of discrepancy, but it doesn't seem so, actually, because in any case, you have convertibility, this implies convertibility into one class, let's say, and just basically you... it's more or less like a deficiency in the dynamics more than in the structure of the theory, more than in the resource theory itself, I'd say. So it's not just the fact that the resource theory is allows for non-classical things, is that I don't have enough dynamics in my underlying theory that allows me to achieve the convertibility because I'm being too restrictive. But in any case, the theory is already captured by some kind of classical behavior.
In a sense, just to add a little thing to Rob's question, it is still true that the argument in the proof is of classical type.
Yes, definitely.
It doesn't use this diagonalization, like going from one eigenbasis to the other, because, well, if you don't have strong symmetry,
yes.
But it uses the fact that you can measure on the eigenvectors of one state, then apply a random classical process, and depending on that, you prepare eigenstates
yes.
of the other state.
Yes.
So it is still of a classical flavor, even in that case.
Indeed, yes. Yeah, because the unital channel that achieves this transition is kind of measure and prepare things, so it's some sort of classically controlled.
Well, we're a bit behind schedule, so let's thank our speaker again.